You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Screens of the Stone Age, the podcast where scientists review movies about prehistoric people. I'm Dr. Joshua Lindell. I am a paleoanthropologist studying Neanderthals, and I'm here with...
I'm Dr. Kimberly Plomp. I am a bioarchaeologist. I study the human skeleton, health and disease, and evolution.
And I'm Dr. Ross Barnett, paleogeneticist interested in Ice Age mammals.
And today we are reviewing the TV series Primal, also known as Genndy Tartakovsky's Primal. How many episodes of this did we watch? We only agreed on watching one episode. I watched a few more ahead to give us a little more context.
Well, I watched one and four babies died, including two dinosaur babies. So I'm not watching any more, and that's horrific. And I'm upset at you, Josh.
This movie
is essentially a snuff film.
This show breaks all the rules and all the children die. Kim, do you know it's six children because the giant monster dinosaur, the two dinosaurs that are eating all those children are in fact a child of an even larger dinosaur. So it's six children are eaten in this movie, in this show, in this episode of this series. So Kim, you didn't like it. Everybody loves this. This is so highly rated. Ross, what did you think?
I mean, it was fine aside from the babies dying.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. I didn't love it, but I thought it was stylistically it was interesting. And yeah, I'm with Kim. I think that one scene where the baby is basically has been, the little kid has been picked up in the mouth of the dinosaur, and then it sort of throws it up in the air, and you see its like panicked eyes just before it gets eaten fully. That's pretty rough for a kid's cartoon.
It's a lot.
Yeah, it is a lot.
Well, I don't think this is a kid's cartoon. I think this is an adult's cartoon.
It was super rough for an adult's cartoon.
Yeah.
It like, honestly, I was having a good day. Thanks.
Well, actually, you can thank a viewer on YouTube who suggested this one. I'm sorry, whoever suggested this in the YouTube comments, I forgot to check what your name was, but you'll know who you are. Somebody requested this in the YouTube comments. They also requested that we do another tier list video sometime, because we did a tier list for our 50th episode, and that was like 3 years ago at this point. So maybe we can... another tier list sometime coming up, maybe episode 200 or something. I guess that'll be a few years away still. So who wants to summarize the first episode of the TV series Primal for us? Spoiler, well, we've already spoiled it, but it's
rough.
Pretty much, it's the introduction to the entire series.
Yeah,
I can do it. It's about trauma, so yeah. I mean, that's why we have children dying.
I don't think Kim wants to revisit it, so I'll jump on that.
Kim isn't even on camera right now. I don't know where Kim is. She's wandered. She has left the recording.
Dealing with my babies.
Oh, dear. Okay, so it opens and we see some fish in a stream. They're going about their fishy lives quite happily. And then a hafted weapon, I think that's important to note, is a composite lithic wood bound with some kind of tendon or what would you call it? Like a twine?
Sinew,
yeah. It comes out of nowhere and kills one of the fish in kind of fairly graphic detail. I mean, there is fish blood.
I thought the fish part was brutal and I was like, oh. And yeah. Then it just got so much worse.
That's just the appetizer. And so we meet the main character. He doesn't have a name. I mean, there's no dialogue throughout this. He's just, I guess, the main character.
The characters do have names canonically that are never spoken, but okay. Well, they're not really names, but the main character is named Spear, and the dinosaur we'll meet later is named Fang.
Okay, good names. Well, Spear, he's a very, he's hench. He's an absolute unit. He reminds me very much of the Incredible Hulk from the 80s cartoon, which I used to watch as a kid. watch as a kid. I mean, the kind of proportions, the squareness are all very reminiscent of that. So he's a big guy. We're not quite sure what species he's meant to be. He doesn't have very obvious features that could place him into like Neanderthal or any other kind of hominid grouping. But he's quite happy there. He's catching fish. He's putting them onto his kind of string catch. And then out of nowhere, a big croc kind of jumps up and almost eats him, but doesn't. And I'm like, okay, that's interesting. Big crocs were definitely around at the same time as early humans. We've got examples from Australia, from Madagascar, from Pacific Islands. That's something we could talk about later. But then just as I'm thinking, oh, okay, this could be good, things get very quiet. And then out of nowhere, what looks to be an Asdarkid pterosaur appears. And I'm like, oh, damn it. It's going to be dinosaurs and people. Mm-hmm. It's got teeth as well, which I don't think the Asdarkids did. Certainly some pterosaurs had teeth, but I don't think the ones that were known for their kind of ornate head crests had teeth. So that's a shame, but it doesn't eat him. We see some theropod footprints, so some three-toed, and at this point I'm guessing meat-eating dinosaurs. And then we hear screams, and that's not good. And so Spear, the main guy, rushes down the valley to what we presume is his home, and at this point you're still thinking, oh great, he's going to go and rescue them, it's going to be fine. But no, we see in pretty short order that this giant theropod dinosaur eats his kids and his wife. Like, and it's quite affecting, I would say. They've done a good job of like making it very jarring and unexpected. Horrifying? Yeah, horrifying.
Yes.
So that's not great. There's three of these dinosaurs after they've eaten his wife and kids. We find out that they're, as Josh was saying earlier, these are just the babies. Like, there's a super massive mother theropod just calls them back to the forest, and off they go. And so the poor Spear, his whole life has just been kind of completely destroyed in the space of like 20 seconds. He's lost his partner. He's lost his, I think they're supposed to be twin children. They're about the same age. He goes back to his cave. His cave is empty. Really sad. He kind of gazes longingly at the family cave art that's drawn, and it looks very much like the decals you get on the back of family size cars, where you have mum, dad, and X number of kids. This is what they've got on the cave wall, and he very sadly looks at it and then rubs it out, which is also quite traumatizing. So he leaves his cave again. He climbs this enormous cliff. We definitely get the sense that he is thinking about ending it all. So there's like definitely suicidal ideation. Kind of, we're supposed to infer from his actions. He kind of stands at the edge of the cliff, knocks some pebbles over the edge, and he's just there waiting to do something. But he doesn't jump. He sort of sits back down on the cliff. He looks up to the sun, which is rising on a new day, and he imagines his wife, his partner, and the twins in the sun, and that, I guess, gives him some reassurance that maybe it's sort of a suggestion of religious sentiments in Spear, the idea of an afterlife, or maybe it's just hallucinations brought on by grief, who knows. But he doesn't jump. He goes back to his old life. He goes back to fishing, which we see that he eats his fish raw, like Gollum from Lord of the Rings, which I also thought was a bit unlikely. Anytime humans eat fish, they're going to be cooking it. Raw fish.
We do see him cooking food that he's hunted in later episodes, so right. I think this might just be a depression.
Okay.
He doesn't have the wherewithal to light a fire and cook his food at this point.
Fair enough.
He doesn't have a family to take care of anymore, right? Yeah. Like. Mm-hmm.
He's been through a lot.
Yeah.
Anyway, while he's eating his raw fish, he sees some dinosaurs, and so he kind of gets a bit Hulk-like and angry, and he goes off, I think, with the idea that we're supposed to assume he's going to kill these dinosaurs in revenge, even though they're clearly not the same ones. There's a color difference between the dinosaurs he sees now and the dinosaurs that ate his whole family. So he kind of rushes in a homicidal or dinocidal rage. But he stopped when he sees this dinosaur that he's about to take out his wrath on has young of its own. So it's very much a mirror image of his own family. And he would be just as bad as the dinosaurs that ate his whole family if he did the same to this ostensibly innocent dinosaur. But then, out of nowhere, the bad dinosaurs, the red-colored ones, the ones that ate his family, appear, and they start sort of chasing the innocent dinosaur. And Spear is not going to stand for this. He sees the opportunity to do something good and help save these innocents. So he fights back against the bad dinosaurs. He picks up a big stone, breaks the leg of one of them with the stone. He kind of throws his spear at some of the other ones. He jumps onto the head of one of them and breaks the tooth off and uses its own tooth to stab it in the head. That's not great. I think he manages to kill one of the younger ones, but then, like we saw earlier, these are just the young ones. The mother of them is still around, and she turns up, and she immediately eats the baby dinosaurs, which is also quite sad. We just got used to them, start to like them. And this enrages Spear further, so he attacks everything, all the bad dinosaurs he can see. At one point, he jumps into the mouth of the mother theropod, and we think that's the end, but no, he still has a spear, and he uses that to basically spear it from the inside right through its throat, and then puts a spear in its brain, and that's it. He's managed to kill these like enormous sort of 100-foot long dinosaurs. They're absolutely out of all scale as to what kind of size actual dinosaurs would be. But anyway, so that's it. The good dinosaurs' babies have been eaten, but the good dinosaur is still around, and it is in a mirror of Spear is now sad that it's lost its family. And we see it curling up in its now empty nest. And it's really sad. I never expected to feel sad for a dinosaur, but it's quite sad.
Heartbreaking.
But Spear kind of wanders off. We see him walking on a beach. There's a nice kind of shot of him brooding and walking along the sand. And then we find the bereaved mother dinosaur, the good dinosaur, is actually following him. And so he kind of jumps on its back. And now he has his own kind of dinosaur mount, and that's the end of the episode. He's now off to more adventures to fight for truth, justice, and the caveman way.
All right, well, now normally we're gonna start by nitpicking inaccuracies. I knew this was going to be a tough one to do because yes, it's cavemen and dinosaurs together, but that's like the whole premise, right? On Wikipedia, you know, it talks about the production of this, and it says this was an idea that Tartakovsky had, but he sort of put it on the back burner, and he was like, he wants to make a show about cavemen and dinosaurs together, but he's like, people are not going to believe it because everybody knows cavemen didn't live with dinosaurs, right? So
like, let's market it in America. It'll be fine.
Well, it said that, here's the quote from Wikipedia, Tartakovsky felt that people would not take the show seriously because they were, quote unquote, breaking the rules by having a, quote unquote, man and dinosaur together. So he emphasized that it is a character study, a buddy's journey about two characters who are very different but bonded by tragedy. So, like, the creators know cavemen and dinosaurs didn't live together. This is an alternate reality and like an alternate history. So, you know, cavemen and dinosaurs together, but we're just going to have to accept that for now. I would say this is leaning into the swords and sorcery style, even though we don't have any swords or sorcerers. It also says that he was inspired by Conan the Barbarian, which is like a classic swords and sorcery movie, or like archetypal swords and sorcery movie, maybe. We've kind of covered this. The swords and sorcery genre bleeds into the caveman genre. Mm-hmm. We watched a movie called Iron Master, which I would say is very swords and sorcery, but another one of these more grounded caveman because there's no sorcerers in it, even though it's like very Conan the Barbarian coded. You guys remember that one with the gay porn actor who played the lead guy who's branched off into his peaceful village and then the bad village learned how to make swords from a volcano?
Yeah.
Oh,
who could forget?
So cavemen living with dinosaurs, we're gonna have to accept it. Maybe we can talk about the dinosaurs. So the thing about this one is it's kind of grounded by mostly using realistic, kind of like inspired by realistic dinosaurs rather than dragons, you know. In later episodes we discover we have other types of human ancestors or proto-humans. From what I understand, in season two, we get more characters. We get a little bit of dialogue. For the first season, there's no dialogue at all. But in the second season, we get different types of humans. So everywhere it's written that this character Spear is a Neanderthal. And later in the first season, he encounters some more primitive human-like creatures. In the second season, he encounters modern humans living in some societies that sort of mirror ancient Egypt or old Norse societies. And he apparently in the second season meets up with a modern human woman. And by the end of that season, they have a hybrid modern human Neanderthal child. So it's not real history, but it is inspired by real history. So I guess that's what we can look at. What is everything inspired by? How close is it to real life?
I guess there's some interesting parallels with the recent research looking at Neanderthal sapien hybridization and finding clear signs of unidirectionality in it. So the paper, which I've downloaded but not read, I think from what I remember, is that there was clear signs that the genetic signature that we've been left with from hybrids between Neanderthals and humans shows a preference either of Neanderthal males for sapien females or of sapien females for Neanderthal males, whichever way you want to spin it. That looks like the coupling that was most left in the fingerprint of modern human populations, which is interesting because that's what it seems like second season does. You've got a supposedly Neanderthal male with a sapiens female.
I remember something a long time ago, and I'm sure the research has surpassed this at this point, but something about Y chromosome, something about like higher rate of infertility in males or something. Could that factor into that somehow?
I think that was the origin point for the study. So they were looking at the distribution of Neanderthal genes within modern human populations. I'm finding that there was very little. It was very sort of sex discrimination. There was a sex difference between the sex chromosomes as to how much Neanderthal DNA was on them compared to the autosomes, so the rest of the genome. So I'm frantically trying to find the paper so I can make sure that I'm not just talking absolute nonsense. But I think that was the start of the paper. So they were looking at what could explain this asymmetric distribution of genes between the sex chromosomes and the autosomes. But yeah, talk amongst yourselves while I try and find this.
Well, we could talk about the appearance of the character because, I mean, it's never spoken in the show as far as I know, but on Wikipedia, on IMDb, everybody calls him a Neanderthal.
I mean, he doesn't have a chin and his forehead goes back. So
yeah,
like that's pretty Neanderthal.
I like his design a lot. He's got a big face. His eyebrow is not overly accentuated, which is one of the, you know, usually when we see a caveman, a big eyebrow and that's all they do. This one has the advantage of being a cartoon, so you don't have to put prosthetics on a modern human face. So no chin. The eyebrow isn't exaggerated. I think it's fine. The only problem I really have is his nose is small and kind of sunken, whereas in a Neanderthal, that nasal area would be much more inflated. But other than that, I like his design quite a bit. And of course, he's exaggerated because he's a Neanderthal. So he, like you said, looks like the Incredible Hulk. Neanderthals were pretty stocky, but that's an exaggeration. I also like the design of his kids. They look Neanderthal to me, but his wife doesn't look like a Neanderthal. No. She is super anorexic, skinny, and her face, you know, there's nothing in it that doesn't say modern human to me. So I think you've got that sort of juxtaposition of the huge, muscly man and the tiny waif-like woman. And I think they're doing like a, you know, a contrast there, but she doesn't really look Neanderthal at all to me.
Mm. The kids, though, they don't even, they look like little demons.
Yeah, like Jack-Jack from The Incredibles.
That didn't make it easier to watch them get eaten?
Did you find it, Ross?
I'm just reading it just now. So, okay, so in the abstract, so there's a 62% relative excess of modern human ancestry in Neanderthal X chromosomes. So the character isn't between two, it's predominantly male Neanderthals with female sapiens. So yeah, so I was few. I was actually.
Oh yeah, I remember that paper.
Yeah. So yeah. They because of the this sort of biased hybridization pattern, that's why they get an excess of modern human ancestry on Neanderthal X chromosomes, because it's there's more X chromosomes moving from the sapiens into the Neanderthal groups because they're preferentially mating with sapien females who have two X chromosomes. I think that's the gist of it.
So Neanderthal males are preferentially, it's more Neanderthal males meeting with female Homo sapiens than it is male Homo sapiens mating with female Neanderthals.
Exactly.
That, and I find that surprising because if I were to have guessed which one it would be, I would have guessed that it would be more, that we'd at least see the genetic material more that it would be Neanderthal mothers, because the Neanderthal cranium really is not the right shape to fit through a human
pelvic point.
You know, they've done a study to see, and it is possible to fit through, but it would be really dangerous, much more dangerous than a human, a modern sapien infant fitting through a Neanderthal pelvic canal. So female Homo sapiens can birth Neanderthal babies, but it's even tighter than with Homo sapien, which is already so tight that it was a leading cause of maternal and infant death before modern medicine, and even now still is a huge cause of death. So you add on a different shape cranium and that occipital bun and stuff, right? And like it's so, yeah, that's what I found surprising, is that I thought it would be, even if there was not necessarily an actual difference in the mating, but there would be a difference in the survival of the infant.
So, I mean, maybe that suggests that this is, if anything, an underrepresentation, because if you're factoring in, like you say, increased mortality from trying to get a Neanderthal head through a sapien birth canal, then the fact that, that we're still seeing an excess suggests that there must have been even more occasions where it happened. Yeah, so that's interesting.
Yeah, I would assume. Yeah.
And that paper is Platt et al. From Science in
just a couple this weeks year. Ago.
Yeah, so February 2026. Yeah.
Well, I'll put that paper in the show notes.
Yeah.
What do we think about the dinosaurs? We can try and figure out, we've got, two dinosaurs and a pterosaur.
I assumed it was a Ceratosaurus and then a Tyrannosaurus, but the sizes were way off.
Well, yeah, I noticed that the good dinosaur had two fingers on each hand, which would make it a Tyrannosaur.
Yeah.
The main dinosaur, Fang, is described as a Tyrannosaurus. Not like the size is not over exaggerated for that one. If anything, she's a little too small because he rides her kind of like a horse, right? So but the Ceratosauruses, the young ones, we have a sort of fake out because we have those ones attacking the family and swallowing them whole, and then they we realize like there's the right an size. Even bigger one. Well, the young ones seem the right size for an adult Tyrannosaurus, but then there's an even bigger one, which is absurdly large. We're describing them as a Ceratosaurus because Ceratosaurus has a horn on its nose, which is pretty unusual for a theropod. I was looking up what dinosaur it's actually supposed to be in case there's a horned theropod that has been discovered since I was 10 years old. And, you know, that's when I learned all my dinosaur names. And I found a Reddit thread talking about the series Primal, and they're asking what dinosaur it's supposed to be. And a few people are saying Ceratosaurus, and most people are saying, don't think too hard about it. This is an alternate history.
But I mean, he got the idea from somewhere, right? Like it's
right. Yeah. I think they're inspired by Ceratosaurus. Yeah.
I mean, if it didn't look like a Ceratosaurus, we wouldn't be saying that. So I'm sure he saw it, or maybe it was his favorite dinosaur. Like he just took inspiration from it, I suppose.
But also, it doesn't really look like Ceratosaurus. You know, it kind of looks more Tyrannosaurus, or possibly there is a dinosaur not recently, like 20 or 30 years ago, found that's larger than Tyrannosaurus, which is Giganotosaurus, which doesn't have a horn, but it looks a little different from Tyrannosaurus. Mm-hmm. So they a lot of people are saying they just look like Tyrannosaurus with a horn on its nose. Ceratosaurus, I think, is more closely related to Allosaurus, which, you know, is a little different shaped than Tyrannosaurus. Yeah. Ceratosaurus also, Tyrannosaurus is a late Cretaceous dinosaur. Ceratosaurus is a late Jurassic dinosaur. So they're like, I don't know, like 50-100 million years apart. And Ceratosaurus is about half the size of a Tyrannosaurus. Mm-hmm. So not twice the size as we see in the show here.
I did quite like that they went with like not a typical kind of monotone reptile skin, that they gave it colors and stripes. And stripes, we know from things like tigers, are actually quite useful for a predator that's hunting in wooded or forested landscape.
Mm-hmm.
And don't we also have go ahead, Kim.
If he had added feathers.
That would have been good.
I was also just going to say that we don't have that much info of actual dinosaur coloration, but we do have some from feathers. And don't we have some feather that actually has some stripes, sort of like a beige and brown stripe to
it? Yeah, I think it's Sinoceropteryx. Some of the Chinese Lagerstätten dinosaurs, where they have preserved melanosomes and stuff, they've worked out that there are stripes, and those are theropods, just very small ones. So yeah, so stripes in theropods is not unlikely, but feathers are also almost a certainty, even in things like T-Rex.
Mm-hmm. I don't see why there wouldn't be.
Yeah, because of the animation style, it could be feathers, but it's just not resolved enough to see the individual filaments. Mm-hmm. It could have been feathers. We can just
that's true.
But I'm going to get back on my high horse and say I'm just really annoyed when people do this. Like, there's absolutely no reason why it has to be dinosaurs when Pleistocene mammals are so cool.
Why couldn't it be a saber cat?
Exactly.
Right? That
you could tell exactly the same story, but just with like a saber tooth and have
We do get Pleistocene mammals later in later episodes. So in episode 3, we have mammoths featured very heavily. The mammoths are very big, larger than the T-Rex.
Mm.
And I mean, if we were dealing with like only realistic chronologies here, you'd never get to see a Tyrannosaurus fight a woolly mammoth. So
and that would be bad. Okay, I'll accept that argument, but just it does annoy me because, you know, realistically, it doesn't matter what your antagonist is in this. It could be anything. It doesn't have to be dinosaurs. And maybe I'm letting my bias show, but, you know, we've got so many dinosaurs. Like, everything does dinosaurs. Let's give the Ice Age some love.
Well, let's put it this way, Ross. If this is like a swords and sorcery sort of style thing here, if this was a regular human and a dragon, would you be upset about it? Dragons don't even exist. So,
no,
you know, why can't we take a human and a dinosaur and put them together in a fictional world, right?
Yeah.
Can I answer this one a little bit?
Yeah.
So I think, because I just found out today that one of my best friends is dating a flat earther who doesn't believe in dinosaurs. And so that broke my heart a bit. I'm worried about her.
Yeah.
But I think the thing is that it's really hard for us to be continuously fighting. And by us, I just mean scientists and you know, academics, and then also just people who care about public outreach in terms of science and education and everything. It's like we're fighting this tidal wave where you're saying like, no, this is the way it is. This is the way it is. This is the way it is. But all of the media that you're consuming and everything that's being made is telling you something completely different, right? Mm-hmm. So how do we just keep arguing against this when you grow up watching this? And it might seem really little like, oh, well, it's just, you know, fantasy that dinosaurs are with humans. But I mean, then you get to the, I'm going to get his name right this time, Graham Hancock. Is that right? And so, but then, you know, you get to him and he's spouting like, yes, he's not on dinosaurs. He's spouting something else, but you know, it could be the stuff that he's spouting is just as ridiculous. Mm-hmm. It's the same playbook and it's on Netflix and it's sold as a alternative, like a respectable alternative to what we're saying. So I don't know. I just think that it's, I think, especially in this time of purposeful ignorance, it seems like we're reaching, right? Where it seems to be cool to believe in these weird things and kids are going to be seeing all of this stuff online and in the internet and everything. I don't know. I just don't know why we can't make movies and cartoons and things just be a little bit more accurate when it's not necessarily needed for the plot.
Totally. I'm with you on that. And out of interest, so your friend that's dating the flat earther, how have you seen a picture of him?
No, she just confessed to apparently she's been seeing him for a while and has been scared to tell me. And then she confessed it today.
Oh, dear.
That's, and I was like, I don't even know what to say.
Run, girl. You're a danger.
The sex can't be that good.
No,
right?
I'm just like, thinking, how attractive do you have to be before you overlook the fact that you're clearly insane? Oh, dear.
Yeah. And she is incredibly, she's a very intelligent person. So like, she's aware of all of this. Yeah. I don't know. The shame.
Remember what we learned from the Rap Guide to Evolution. It's on women to not have sex with men.
Yes,
like this.
I should send her that. Yes. Yeah. I think I'm going to go home and make her wear a hair shirt until she dumps him.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's just me.
Just keep sending her like pictures from Artemis 2 and updates on NASA
fake
missions.
Fake news, AI, fake news.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was watching, I was like so trying so hard to avoid reading the comments on those live feeds because every fifth comment is just fake news, AI. It's so fake. Can't you tell that this is AI? And it's like the computer generated visualization that's on the screen at the time. Like, are you a moron? Come on, man. I mean, I know you're a moron because you don't believe that we landed on the moon. But like, seriously,
try and hide it a bit better.
Well, I only have two sort of talking points in my notes for this. One of them is Neanderthals fishing. We start off with him fishing. He's fishing prominently. For a long time, it was kind of understood that Neanderthals didn't fish, but I think that we have evidence of Neanderthals fishing at quite a few sites by now, and also exploiting other marine resources, including shellfish.
Why wouldn't Neanderthals fish?
Well, you have to be, you know, you just see an animal running around and you go stab it. And that's what stupid people can do. But you have to be smart to figure out how to catch a fish, I think, was the bias, which we don't know how they were fishing. Because one of the things is, I don't think we have any evidence of fish hooks. We don't have any evidence of barbed harpoons, these are things we see in the upper Paleolithic when modern humans move into Europe. But we don't have any obvious technologies for catching fish during, Neanderthal occupations.
Like a net wouldn't last, right?
Yeah, but we don't have any evidence for nets until the upper Paleolithic either, except,
of course,
a net is going to decompose. We do have fibers. Yeah. I can't remember if the earliest fibers are from modern human levels or if we have fibers from Neanderthal levels. I can't remember that.
I think there are fibers from Neanderthal levels from some cave sites, which was a bit of a shock.
But even then, like, absence of evidence is not evidence of absence, right? Sure. So it would be very rare for a net to preserve for that long.
Yeah.
And a net's a really good way of catching fish.
It's very much our biases, I think, in the kind of, these guys, there's no clear evidence that they didn't catch fish, therefore they were stupid. And yeah. I think we're moving away from that a bit now, which is good. But even, you know, maybe I'm showing my country roots here, but even things like, you know, tickling for fish, you don't even need any kind of material goods to do that. It's just your hands, and you can catch fish if you've got a little bit of patience.
Well, even their spears, like their fire hardened wood spears, that would be fine for catching fish, right? And then
with a bit of practice, yeah.
I'm sure that there's lots of things that they even thought of that I don't know about because I'm not a fisherman.
One of the common like fishing spear things is to make like a split ended spear with like reverse barbs. So you sort of catch the fish in between, and that would be entirely wood. So you wouldn't necessarily find that much evidence of it. Another one of the pieces of that. Well, first of all, there are fish bones found in Neanderthal caves. And, you know, other animals can bring bones into caves. There's no real certain evidence of who's eating them, but there are some studies looking at sort of like the distributions and sizes of fish and sort of like determining what size of fish is being exploited and interpreting Neanderthals catching fish on that basis.
And I guess also kind of where they're coming from. So marine versus freshwater. My understanding is that some other mammals hunt freshwater fish, like wolves and bears. For instance, we'll take fish from streams, but I can't think of any other mammal that would have used a cave that would be able to catch marine fish apart from humans.
And that does differ between sites. So, of course, at coastal Neanderthal sites, we have coastal marine resources, and at some more inland sites, we do have some freshwater fish represented. But another way that people looked into this is there's the study of
the calculus.
I wasn't even going to say that, but I mean, you're talking about isotopes, looking at the nitrogen.
So, and they found evidence of marine resources being used in the isotopic analysis of Neanderthal calculus, which is calcified plaque on your teeth. So if you don't brush your teeth, your plaque gets really hard and it lasts for thousands of years.
So brush your teeth, kids, or else...
brush your teeth. Yeah.
No, or don't. Don't brush your teeth, because that way archaeologists in the future will be able to understand you better.
Yeah, that's true.
There's the high prevalence of auditory exostoses the Middle Paleolithic, which are that's surfer's ear or something like that. There's these bony growths in the ear canal caused by cold. Ear, I think. Yeah. Swimmer's ear.
And we all said something different.
One of the interpretations of that is that in at coastal sites, Neanderthals were like free diving for marine resources. So they're diving for shellfish, which is something you can obviously do. But like you said, Ross, you can catch fish just with your hands under certain circumstances. And so it's possible that, you know, they're exploiting whatever kind of marine resources they can manage to catch with whatever technology they happen to have, right?
I think we could talk about crocodiles as well, like the big croc that almost gets them at the beginning. And this sort of ties back into my earlier point about how I'm always disappointed when the kind of dangerous animal turns out to be a dinosaur rather than a mammoth or a saber-tooth or whatever. And yeah, I guess I'm just being an old fuddy-duddy by accepting that dragons would have been fine, but dinosaurs is not. But we do have essentially kind of late surviving giant reptiles that could take the place of an enemy. So I'm thinking of things like Megalania priscus or Varanus priscus, as it's known now, the giant Komodo dragon of Australia, which was like bus-sized and pretty terrifying and was around at the same time as people. There's also, you know, plenty of recently extinct crocodilians that could have done the job of a giant kind of dragony reptile dinosaur type thing. So you've got Voe robustus, which is like a weird crocodile with horns that was living in Madagascar until probably about 1500 years ago. So really late surviving, probably mostly a kind of freshwater land dwelling crocodile, but yeah, with horns. So that's cool. You've got things like Mikosuchus, this whole kind of lineage of crocodilians that went out in the Holocene. So within the past couple of thousand years in Southeast Australasia, so Megasuchus, Quincana, these Australian and Pacific crocodiles, which are unlike any other crocodile around just now, but with weird faces and big pointy teeth and lots of scales. So essentially dragons slash dinosaurs, but did overlap with people and could be used as the big bad.
I've mentioned in a recent episode that I've been playing a lot of the video game Far Cry Primal, which I want to figure out how to review, and I want to get you guys to see it. It has lots of pretty realistic Pleistocene mammals, but it also has crocodiles, and it is set in Central Europe. So when is the last time we would have any kind of crocodiles in Europe?
That's a good question. I don't know. I would have to look it up, but if I was to guess, I would imagine that at times when you have things like hippos in Europe, so kind of mid-Pleistocene warm periods, you might have crocodiles then. But let me just frantically Google that. Apparently, according to my quick Googling, 4 million years ago is the last time you had crocodiles in Europe. Mm. But that is a very surface-level search. And so, I mean, one thing about crocodilians is that they... if they're around, they do tend to show up in the fossil record because they have lots of teeth, they have lots of bony scales, and they're mostly skeleton. So they do, taphonomically, they do tend to survive.
Yeah, they're one of the animals where the skull kind of looks exactly like their head.
Yeah. But yeah, that is a really good question. No, maybe there wasn't then.
All right, Neanderthals never met crocodiles. Mm. Is that the answer? Well,
yeah. Probably.
I mean, in the Mediterranean, like, there's...
yeah, maybe.
There's Nile crocodiles, yeah. Right? So, maybe it's possible somewhere in the Levant.
Yeah.
Well, the only other thing I have in my notes is we can talk a little bit about cave paintings, but we talk about that so much, whether Neanderthals had the capacity to make cave paintings. We always mention one of these really old cave paintings from like 65,000 years ago, which is a Neanderthal hand impression, I think, from Spain. So we used to think Neanderthals didn't make cave paintings. Now we think they kind of did sometimes, but not really these sort of drawing style cave paintings so much. In this one, he has painted, it looks like it's done with charcoal. It's he and his family, and then he smears it off the cave wall. One thing is that we never see cave paintings of humans, certainly not in the Upper Paleolithic, where, you know, we see tons of animals painted, but almost never humans. And when we do, they're little stick figures like the Birdman of
Lascaux.
Is that in Lascaux?
Yeah.
But then, as Aurora pointed out to me when we were watching this, he wiped the painting off the wall. So if every time somebody dies, they erase their painting, then we never would find cave paintings of people from any period of time, right?
There's always a cultural explanation.
Kim, I can't hear you. It doesn't say that you're muted, but...
okay, hello, now?
Oh, okay, I can hear you now.
Okay, so my Audacity crashed and then my microphone turned off on its own. So hopefully the Zoom recording works.
Oh, so you crashed and you lost everything?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, hopefully we got the Zoom recording.
If not, you can just redo it and just go in and go like, oh, I don't know about the birds. Maybe the birds
were fine. You could get Aurora to pretend to be Kim.
I don't have to do that because we have AI now. On our last episode, it's not out yet, but we were talking about AI, and we did a joke at the beginning where we got ChatGPT to write us a script. And I sent you guys an email, or I talked to you on a recording about whether we wanted to use a voice generating AI where I feed the AI a bit of audio recording and it would take the text and generate it in our own voices. And we decided that was a little too far for our comfort, but I could very easily write in a script for Kim.
You don't even need me anymore.
I have hundreds of hours of audio from Kim. I could do this podcast without either of you and just write all your parts.
I mean, maybe we aren't here. Maybe we are just a figment of Josh's AI monomania.
So anytime I say something stupid, that's the AI. You just can't trust it.
All right. Well, wrapping up Primal, I think we might have some mixed feelings about it. The thing that it is praised for is its ability to tell a story without any dialogue, and also its balance of violence and emotion, right? So it's like super violent, but it's also, you know, it is very jarring to see these children killed at the first episode here, but I think it is a show about dealing with trauma, so it's supposed to be really heavy. And watching ahead in a few episodes, we see him killing animals to eat, but we also have, you know, it's not just a glorification of violence, even though it is showing us very violent animation. But, you know, in the third episode, they kill a mammoth together, and right before the mammoth dies, its eye, we have a zoom in on its eye, and it looks into, and you see this sadness in its eye, and we see this sort of pain in Spear's eye as he's, you know, killing this mammoth. And in another episode, we have a flashback where he's hunting with his son. He's basically taking his son on the first hunt, and they kill a deer together. And so you sort of see this mix of emotion in the boy, where he's excited to be on his first hunt, but he's also sad at having to kill this animal. And you know, the father Spear is also sad, and they kill it and they're successful, and they don't look triumphant. They sort of are almost mournful over having killed this animal. So it has this really interesting level of emotion we don't usually get from violent cartoons like this, you know.
I don't know. Tom and Jerry also was quite good at emotions, and it was very violent. Yeah, I mean, Tarkovsky, he's done other things. He did Clone Wars, didn't he? That's his work.
He did. I think he's most well-known for Dexter's Lab and Samurai Jack. I've never seen Samurai Jack. Some of my friends watched Dexter's Lab when it was on, but I didn't have satellite TV at the time, so I missed out on the 90s generation of cartoons.
We did an episode of that, didn't we?
Yeah, I think we did.
No, we did Phineas and Ferb.
Oh.
But this character, Spear, is pretty much identical to a caveman that we see in one episode of Dexter's Lab. And so I was wondering, maybe in the future we can do Dexter's Lab. I'm pretty sure this caveman only appears in one episode. So if anybody is a fan of Dexter's Lab, and maybe there's other dinosaur or history episodes, we could do a compilation of Dexter's Lab like we did for Phineas and Ferb. If you're a fan of Dexter's Lab, let us know if there's other episodes we could cover. So, any final thoughts about Primal?
No. Well, it's going to stay with me because it's awful.
I'm a little surprised because this one is so highly rated. Everybody loves this show. I guess killing the children is too traumatic and is going to turn a few people off in the first episode. And maybe that's going to filter out the people who can handle that kind of thing, who are going to stick with it.
You have a heart.
But yeah. I think you need to have a heart to appreciate it, because, you know, you have to identify with that trauma, because, you know, the whole series is about him processing that trauma, right?
With his emotional support dinosaur.
With his emotional support dinosaur. But the dinosaur is also processing her trauma, because she just went through the same thing. So it's about these characters bonding over their trauma and learning how to grieve together, and also killing other dinosaurs.
Yeah.
Well, thanks to Tyler on YouTube for suggesting this one to us. I looked up your name to make sure you got credit.
Tyler.
Tyler, I'm sorry that Kim didn't enjoy this series as much as you did. But if you're watching us on YouTube, leave us suggestions in the comments and we will cover them. If you're listening on a podcast app, send us an email at screensandstoneage.com, or get in touch with us on Blue Sky or Facebook. Kim, do you ever check the Facebook?
I get notified if anybody messages, so no one messages.
Well, if you want to suggest something for us to review, let us know at one of those places. If you have questions, comments, or movie requests, we want to hear from you. Find us on Blue Sky and Facebook at SOTSA Podcast. Send us an email to screensofthestoneage@gmail.com or visit our website at screensofthestoneage.com.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.